50s.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
ICE, unmask. What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of?
That is Gavin Newsom. Just 3 days ago, the governor of California, very proud that he had signed a law requiring law enforcement officers of ICE to do their jobs without wearing masks. And then early this morning in Dallas, Texas. There was a shooting at the ICE facility in Dallas, Texas, and what happened was the Dallas PD explained what had happened about 6:42 local time in Dallas, Texas this morning.
Today at approximately 6:40 a.m., we received an assist the officer call. We responded to the call, got to the scene, and we later learned that we had four individuals that were shot. Two of them deceased, including the shooter.
Including the shooter, who is dead now, took his own life. A killer with a rifle opened fire from a nearby rooftop onto a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement location in Dallas, Texas. He killed two detainees and wounded another and then took his own life. So that is the bottom line, is that three people are dead. The killer is also dead, but we don't count him in the victims of this shooting. They say, and this is the line we've heard about just about every shooting in America in the last decade or so, the exact motivation for the attack not immediately known. But only if you're not paying attention, because the head of the FBI, Kash Patel, has released a photo on social media that shows a bullet or bullets found at the scene with the words anti-ICE written on them in what appears to be some kind of marker, Sharpie or something like that. Dallas ICE shooter has now been identified as an anti-ICE activist, 29-year-old Joshua John, who had left-wing views and may have been influenced by Antifa, and then Todd Lyons, acting director of ICE.
This just shows the violence that's being increased against ICE officers and agents. This is the second time now we've had a shooting at one of our facilities in the Dallas area.
And that's what's happened. So where has all this anti-ICE talk been coming from? Almost exclusively from the group known as Antifa, which has now been labeled as both a domestic and international terrorist organization, that designation coming from President Donald Trump. And you understand, what's happening is the left in America has been talking out against ICE for a long, long time. Let me give you a sampling of that. How about Hakeem Jeffries, member of the United States House of Representatives?
Every single ICE agent who's engaged in this aggressive overreach and are trying to hide their identities from the American people will be unsuccessful in doing that. This is America. This is not the Soviet Union. We're not behind the Iron Curtain. This is not the 1930s. And every single one of them, no matter what it takes, no matter how long it takes, will, of course, be identified.
Now, here's the thing about that. You say, we want to know who's working in law enforcement. Hakeem Jeffries says it is overreach for ICE to go out and actually enforce federal laws that have been on the law books in America for literally decades. That is absolutely crazy. These laws are not Donald Trump's laws. These are laws that were passed by the U.S. Congress back when Donald Trump was still registered as a Democrat, long before he ran for president the first time. So all he's doing is telling a federal law enforcement agency to go out and enforce the federal laws that have been part of the law books for decades. Donald Trump would like to get some laws changed, but Congress hasn't done that. They didn't do it during his first term of office. They certainly have not done it during his second term of office, despite the fact that we have a Republican majority on Capitol Hill. So all he's doing is enforcing the law, and that's all the ICE agents are doing. And yet this is being cast by Democrats as some kind of overreach. And what has that resulted in? It's resulted in attacks on ICE facilities all over the United States. Here is FBI Special Agent in Charge Joe Rothrock.
Back on July 4th, we saw a coordinated attack carried out against an immigration detention center in Alvarado, Texas. What I can also share with you is that early evidence that we've seen from rounds that were found near the suspected shooter contain messages that are anti-ICE in nature.
Anti-ICE in nature. And what have we seen elsewhere? We've seen ICE facilities throughout the United States that have been laid siege by Antifa. Antifa has decided to attack those facilities. Most of them are in liberal cities, blue cities, and most of those cities are so-called sanctuary cities, where the cities and sometimes the states have literally said, we are going to be a sanctuary for illegal aliens. We are going to do everything we can to keep the federal law enforcement folks from actually enforcing the law. So they're aiding and abetting illegal aliens in staying in America. And then, of course, we had the 4 years of Joe Biden, where Joe Biden openly invited a surge at the border. Do you remember when he said that in the debates before the election was even held that put him in office? I don't say elected him, because I don't think the 2020 election actually elected Joe Biden, but that's a subject for another day. The fact is, Joe Biden said there will be a surge at the border. I don't think any of us could have imagined what would happen. Just the other day at the United Nations, Donald Trump talked about the total number of illegal aliens that have come into this country and did come in during Joe Biden. He put the number at 25 million. Even the other estimates put it at least 16 million, and about 10 million of those stayed in the United States. And it has brought tremendous damage to American cities. We've had schools that are overcrowded because of illegal aliens. We've had crime that has gone up sharply because of illegal aliens. Americans have been murdered. Americans have been raped. There have been terrible crime waves that were driven by illegal aliens. And finally, we got a president who say we're going to close the border, and he has. It is sealed just about as tight as America's southern border has ever been sealed. And ICE is now able to actually go out and do its job. So what happens then? America's political left literally attacks ICE. And I think a lot of this is driven by the words of people who are elected to office under the banner of the Democrat Party, Party of Slavery, since 1829. One good example of that, Representative Jasmine Crockett from Texas. Take a listen to what she says about ICE.
When I see ICE, I see slave patrols. Now, I never lived through the slave patrol period, but if you know the history of policing in this country, then you understand that they were born out of slave patrols.
Now, hold on a second. So this is an actual member of Congress. She is a Democrat, so I don't expect her to be all that bright, but she apparently believes that before there were slave patrols to go out and grab runaway slaves and drag them back to their owners. By the way, their owners in favor of slavery were all Democrats. The Klan was all Democrats. That before that, America had no law enforcement. You had no sheriffs. You had no police departments. You had none of that. That all of policing is born out of slave patrols. That's the official story of Representative Jasmine Crockett. That kind of talk is what is driving the anti-ICE activities of Antifa and other groups. And today we have the latest acts of violence carried out by somebody who identified with Antifa and identified with the anti-ICE point of view. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey,
no need to adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, Oregon's allegedly green energy agenda is costing taxpayers a bundle, and it actually produces more pollution instead of less pollution. Many of you are hearing this while you're stuck in your cars in the region's perennially congested freeways. Tens of billions have been spent over the decades to build dozens of miles of light rail line, both in Portland and in Puget Sound, and yet transit ridership isn't rising, it's actually falling. If you consider where we stood before the pandemic and the government's overreaction to the pandemic and its disruption of the economy, transit use dropped from almost 10% to about 7.5%. Driving rose at the same time from 65% to more than 68%. Working from home, it went up by about 170% in the last 5 years. Cascade Policy Institute's numbers show that remote work has cut commuting by cars by 6%, but it cut transit ridership by almost half. Diverting billions to rail and then deciding not to build roads to solve the congested freeways, the wasted fuel from that mistake now totals more than 35 million gallons a year, and that's only in the Portland area. Meanwhile, ODOT has grown a fat bureaucracy of nearly 5,000 workers that constantly pleads poverty and demands that we all pay more money to get less in the way of roads and freeways. My suggestion, build the roads that people actually need and pave them with pink slips. Your calls are welcome on the Radio Northwest Network right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And by the way, if you want to cast a vote in our X poll, we put up a brand new poll question every day. This is crazy. Hillary Clinton. Yes, Hillary is still around. She has blasted the Trump administration for not delivering what she calls due process to narco-terrorists shipping drugs into the United States. She says, look at what they're doing in the Caribbean, shooting boats, you know, boats with 7 or 10 people in them. No due process, no real definition of why, other than they might be drug runners. They don't have to kill those people. So the question I want to ask you is, should narco-terrorists who are shipping drugs into the U.S. get their day in court, or was Trump right to take them out? I would vote for take them out. And Hillary says, we have no way of knowing if those are drug runners. Actually, the United States government and the military does know that they were drug runners. That's why they blew them up. I swear. Hillary Clinton and any other dimwit Democrat who says, no, don't go out and kill those terrorists, pull them over, as she said. You should pull them over and take them into custody. Well, first of all, those boats were blown up in international waters. In other words, you don't have any authority to pull them over the way a cop can pull you over on a street in the United States. Even the Coast Guard does not have jurisdiction out there. But if we're going to protect this country from the roughly 100,000 drug overdoses that are killing 100,000 Americans every single year, you've got to take out the narco-terrorists. And they are terrorist organizations. They are engaged in a chemical war against the United States. And I think Trump is right to do what he's doing. So should the narco-terrorists shipping drugs in the U.S. get their day in court, as Hillary Clinton suggests, or was Donald Trump right to take them out? Again, I'll vote for take them out. Today's X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Peter Harris, retired military, writes in, Lars, this was in my business email this morning. Why does ODOT have a civil rights department? Their job is to maintain the roadways. I just thought this was some more bureaucracy that your listeners should know about before Queen Tina steals more of our money. Last little thought, if these liberals are so worried about tyrants, very respectfully, Peter Harris. Let me tell you something. The Civil Rights Division of ODOT does exist. It's been around for decades, and I think it's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard of. And if you say, well, Lars, don't you care about the civil rights of citizens? I absolutely do. And if somebody out there thinks that their civil rights have been violated, you know where they can turn? They can turn to the state of Oregon's Department of Justice, which has its own civil rights division. Why does ODOT need their own civil rights division that duplicates what is available at the Department of Justice, State of Oregon, and also duplicates the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice? So it's just a third level of bureaucracy. And if you're out of money to pave the roads, you can't very well turn around and say, but we have the money to employ a whole bunch of people in a civil rights division for a single state agency. My favorite post on X today, but you can always post up more. Brandon Leslie said, Lars, Gavin Newsom said that people need to push back on ICE agents because they're the result of an authoritarian government. And then this morning, a sniper shot up an ICE facility. He's absolutely right. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to the Oregon Health Authority and to the state of Oregon. They always make a lot of noise about how they're not going to cooperate with the Trump administration. And then when they decide to do it, they do it very quietly. They don't want to say one word to the public. So here's what's happened. Oregon health officials have now turned over personal data about Medicaid patients to the federal government as part of a spending probe. Earlier this month, the health authority sent the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services a report containing data on every adult who uses Medicaid services. Now, a couple of months ago, Oregon was saying, we will not comply. And then when they say, but your money's at risk, and they say, okay, we will comply, but we'll do it very, very quietly. And don't you love the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper and their selective truth-telling about Medicaid? Here's the way the OregonLive.com describes it. State's Medicaid program that provides health coverage for 1.4 million low-income individuals and people with disabilities. The Daily Dead Fish Wrapper deliberately leaves out my three favorite categories of Medicaid recipients. Number one, doctors who surgically or chemically mutilate children in the name of trans, paid for by Medicaid. Deadbeats who won't get a job even though they are able-bodied, childless, and of working age, covered by Medicaid. Illegal aliens, covered by Medicaid. Those are the favorite categories. You'll never hear the fish wrapper mention that. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes because I hired them to do it for me. Check them out at CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. So Rob in Idaho writes in, Lars, liberal white women are taking Tylenol whether they need it or not just because, well, orange man bad. They have a severe case of Trump derangement syndrome. Their little pea brains can't stand anything good that would come from a Nazi. I don't know myself. I've been taking acetaminophen all my life. But we also thought heroin was medicinal at one point. Maybe the president should come out and say that botulinum toxin is bad for you as well. Signed, Rob in North Idaho. It's Wednesday. It's my pleasure to be with you, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls. We'll do that in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And join me in welcoming Aaron Mesh, Managing Editor at Willamette Week. Aaron, I never in my life thought we'd end up talking about Renfair on this program. Welcome to the program, and tell me why the Renaissance Fair is about to be, what, regulated out of existence or what?
You know, people are always saying to me that this country is going backwards, and so I feel like it's appropriate somehow that you and I are stepping back in time to the Middle Ages. Come on, that was pretty good.
What happened at Renfair that got them sideways with the regulators of the state of Oregon?
So there were two workplace injuries in 2024 at the Oregon Renaissance Fair. For those who are not familiar, it's a month-long weekend event, so four weekends in June, held at the Clackamas County Fairgrounds, and they transformed the fairgrounds into a mythical place called the Vale of Dunrose. There's a two-story castle, there are vendors. You know, it's a very much like a county fair. The county fair just had more jousting instead of livestock shows, right? Like, so I myself grew up being a rabid 4-H'er and never really got into the Renaissance fair thing, but you know, if you like fairs, this is a certain kind of one with big turkey legs, etc. Point is that OSHA has been receiving complaints from a group of whistleblowers who are concerned about safety regulations at the fair, and they came out this summer and discovered a variety of concerns, including a basket that wasn't properly attached to a forklift, workers out in hot temperatures without places to cool off. You know, it's fairly basic stuff when it comes to like workplace safety. But I think what makes it interesting is that it is a seasonal event, which are sometimes not as closely monitored. And honestly, I'm just going to be quite frank, there's a sexiness element about like it being a bunch of people who go by knights and wenches that is extremely funny.
Well, they don't get any escape from OSHA regs just because they're portraying something that happened hundreds and hundreds of years ago or kind of society like that. They don't get to say, hey, there was no OSHA back then.
No, they don't. But for some reason, I think it's funny that they might make that argument. Realistically, I think like to the degree that this story has anything to say more largely about government and culture, it would be that there have been a variety of fairly alarming incidents at seasonal events like, you know, like we're talking about like the classic carny thing, right, where like people come to town for a week with the midway and they put things up and you ride the roller coaster and they tear it back down, right? So like, yep. the like very basic, like it goes all the way back to the days of Barnum and Bailey and even before that when circuses arrived at the edge of town, and those events I think most people, including me, have a healthy skepticism about the safety of those events. I think you know that if you're going to an event where the roller coaster's only been up for 24 hours, that it might not be as safe as Six Flags, right?
I'm with you all day. In fact, Aaron, do you know what it takes me? One of my favorite events in the Northwest, and in part because I went to high school in Tillamook, so I went to the fair every year. Have you ever seen the Pig and Ford races?
Oh, yeah, I love the Pig and Ford races.
But do they look like a OSHA inspector's nightmare when you say, we're going to have people run across an uneven track, pick up a pig under your arm, go to your model, I think it was a Model T or Model A, crank start it, those things were notorious for occasionally breaking people's arms, then jump into this vehicle with no seatbelt, no roll cage, no none of that, and race around the track, come back, drop the pig back in, pick another pig out, jump back in, start your car if you have to. Yeah, I can just imagine when OSHA's done with it, they'll all be wearing five-point harnesses. They'll be wearing helmets with face guards. The pigs will have to be sterilized in some way to make sure that you're not getting any stuff on your hands that would get you sick. I mean, in other words, if you let OSHA loose on the Pig and Ford races, I think they would just simply disappear.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And I think that, like, going back to a joke you made earlier that I think does kind of cut to the heart of the story, it's a culture clash, right? That, like, these are events that are janky by nature, that are up and down in a short period of time, and there was no OSHA in 1478. So I do think that, like, you have a culture clash between these tightly knit organizations of seasonal volunteers and employees who are very like mission driven about their entertainment, and the safety questions that and the culture of regulation that OSHA has. Now, where I will like say that I don't think this is just a classic case of government overreach is that there are people who work these jobs who in two different cases got whacked on the head because unsecured objects landed on their head. And you don't want people who are working for a living to suffer traumatic brain injuries.
No, you don't. But I guess I just wonder, do we all have any kind of allowance for those kinds of things? Because I can imagine what OSHA would do with most rodeo events. Or, you know, I mean, you could probably go down and make a long list. What would OSHA do with river rafting in the Northwest, which is a popular sport?
Sure.
I've done it myself.
Enough.
And you say, that looks inherently unsafe. Well, let's let OSHA go to town. And at the end of it, you end up with people wrapped up in cotton padding, you know, and unable to actually go out and enjoy the thing they like to do. Send OSHA out to Smith
Rocks. I don't disagree with you, but I will note that, like, let's say, for example, the Pendleton Roundup as a great rodeo example.
Love that.
Classic
work.
Oregon events. I love that event so much. I don't think it's ever, watch somebody hop on the email and tell me I'm wrong, but I don't think it has a long history of OSHA violations. And in fact, I think OSHA has largely left it alone, in part because it's really well run. And so I think one of the things that we see with this particular event is that the people who are driving this complaint and that are alerting OSHA here are, in fact, the people who work at the Oregon Renaissance Fair. So it's Ren Fair lifers who are most concerned about this, which would suggest that, like, unlike a lot of the county fairs and midways that are well run, there may be some valid concerns here.
Well, and in fact, one of the things your story, and I'm talking to Aaron Mesh, the managing editor at Willamette Week, you can find the story at WWeek.com, is that you didn't provide people with heat illness prevention training. And I'm thinking, if you live in the Northwest, it's not hot most of the time, but when it is hot, do you understand how to stay cool? Do you understand that you've got to drink a lot of water? You have to occasionally seek shade, wear loose-fitting clothing and light clothing and that sort of thing. Is it really up to the employer in that case to say, we've got to train you how to deal with heat as though you're a kid in kindergarten or something?
Yeah, I mean, legally it is. There's no question about that. I see the workplace signs in my workplace that tell me things that I think are pretty obvious. And I think there's a perfectly valid philosophical debate to be had over whether or not the government's being a nanny state here, but it's a debate that probably has been going on at least since the 60s of whether or not government is over-regulating businesses on safety issues or whether or not, like, employees could, like, actually learn to take care of themselves.
You know, I think Mark Zussman should sign you up for training.
Goes on forever.
To make sure you don't accidentally stab yourself with a pencil, Aaron, because it's and that you wear safety goggles because, you know, that lead can pop right back from the pencil and hit you right in the eyeball, and bad things will happen. You should read the story at WWeek.com. Ren Fair is in trouble with OSHA, and no, you don't get a pass just because it happened hundreds of years ago, and this is just a recreation of that. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And how about the ugly tactics that are being used to combat signature gathering for the folks at Let's Go Washington? That's next on the Radio Northwest Network.
Actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. By the way, there are some reports that are coming down at this point, unconfirmed, but apparently MSNBC is reporting that James Comey, the fired and disgraced former head of the FBI, is expecting indictment anytime in the next couple of days. Three sources telling MSNBC he's expected to be indicted. And what for? Well, he apparently lied under oath to Congress, which is, of course, a violation of the law, and it can get you in trouble. Because if you commit perjury in front of Congress and you're under oath, then that's not supposed to happen. So the breaking news is that James Comey, former director of the FBI, and is, in my book, one of the most corrupt individuals ever to serve in our government, but that's just my personal point of view. There is evidence to suggest that Comey lied to Congress in his testimony in 2020. And if you lie to Congress under oath, you can be indicted for that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. On that note, let's go to Sarah in Bend, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KBND. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, there's a nice community center here in Bend
where there's a swimming pool, and it's run by the Bend Park and Recreation. There's also other parts to it, but the swimming pool women's dressing room has been open to a transgender man who changes his clothes in there.
Wow.
And I
assume somebody has complained about this, right, Sarah?
Oh, yeah. I've complained loudly, and this has been going on for about a month. I've written letters to the park department, and I've had a phone call from them and also from the manager at the pool. I've written a letter to the legislature for every single one of my representatives all over the state. Let's see, what other kind of complaint?
Well, Sarah, when you talk to the parks department, what did they tell you?
Oh, they are following the law, which is ORS 659A.403. And that is DEI, which also does that everybody gets to be in the changing room that accommodates their gender identity.
Yep. That's the law. And so they've just told you doesn't matter if this man is sitting in there in the women's locker room while women are disrobing and changing either into or out of their swim gear. The man can sit in there and his presence is protected.
Yes. And in addition to this, there are four changing rooms that are private. And we would have suggested that maybe he would use one of those private changing rooms. But no, he gets to choose whether or not he wants to use one of those, and so do we. So we get 20 people jammed into one of those little changing rooms, or one of those four that might be open, while he has his run of the whole dressing room, unless there's somebody that doesn't mind changing in front of him.
Wow.
But we got to change our clothes and when we go in and change our clothes when we get back out. And there's not enough space to do it in those little private dressing rooms, and they're usually occupied by somebody that really needs them, like a grandmother with her grandkids, or like a handicapped person.
Well, I wish they would do something about this. And Sarah, you know what I've been waiting to have happen? Are there any young ladies who work at the recreation center who might file a complaint saying, you're exposing me to a hostile work environment if you're telling me that I have to go in there and do work, you know, as my job as one of the staff here, as a woman, where there's a dressing room, where there's a man who's going to be dressing and undressing. I would think that the one law would collide with the other law and say, you can't tell an employee that they have to do this because that's putting them in a hostile environment. I mean, we used to hear about hostile environments because of off-color jokes that idiots would tell or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you tell a young lady who's working as one of the staff at the rec center that she's got to go in and be exposed to this man dressing or undressing, I would think that that would be a hostile work environment and she'd have a legitimate complaint, wouldn't you?
I would think so. And I could look for someone like that. I think most of the staff is cowed by this. I know of one who has resigned, and I also know that there's a number of the women who don't come anymore. One said she had panic attacks, one said she had been abused and was just she was unable to go in there when it was like that.
Isn't that you know, the Parks Department, I think, should go out and act, and I understand they're strapped down by the law, but if they can't talk to this member and say, your behavior in going in and dressing and undressing in front of these women is creating a problem. And I have, you know, there's a dirty little secret out there, Sarah, is that they always say this is an LGBTQ++, et cetera, issue. There are an awful lot of lesbians, there are an awful lot of gay men who are not happy at all that the transgender have hooked to their little cause onto their political activity, because they say, we don't do this kind of stuff. And you're making us look bad because all of a sudden we're associated with you and your bad behavior. Because I think it's highly rude behavior I mean, you can say, well, I have a I have a right to do it under state law. You may have a right to do all kinds of things under state law. But if you're doing something that is demonstrably harmful to the people in the society that you live in, and you say, well, I have a right to do it, too bad. I'll tell you what, that kind of attitude does not make anybody warm up to your cause. Sarah, thanks so much for the call. It's Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. You think you need
enough? You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I got a couple of facts to start with. Number one, the two states with the highest gas prices in all of the United States of America are Washington State, where I happen to live, so you might say I have a dog in the fight, and California. Highest gas prices in America. And Washington State has a carbon market for these carbon credits, which, as far as I'm concerned, are like magic beans. They really don't exist, but the government has brought them into existence to charge people more money for fuel and energy in just about every form it takes if it's made out of fossil fuels. Quebec also has a carbon market, and now the idea is surfaced to join Washington State into California and Quebec's carbon market. The guy who knows this subject better than I do is Brett Davis, who is the Pacific Northwest editor for the Center Square. Brett, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thanks so much. Well, I also happen to live here, so I guess I have a dog in the fight, too.
Well, and that's
go
it.
Out, fill up.
If people want to say, well, Lars, you're affected by this, okay, fine, I've disclosed that. So tell me this. Why in the world would any American state want to join with another state in a carbon market, let alone a foreign province of a foreign country, even if they are right next door and they don't really feel like a foreign country? Why would we want to do that?
Right now, according to the Department of Ecology, and this goes back to a report they put out all the way back in October of 2023, they've concluded that being part of a larger climate market should result in companies paying lower prices for emission allowances in Washington. And the report also warns, and I think this is a bit telling, that not pursuing linkage could be a mistake that endangers the entire program. So I would say Ecology is highly motivated to get this linkage program up and running, which is what they're, you know, working on right now. There were a couple of events this month that forwarded that goal. Earlier this month, September 5th, the State Department of Ecology, they ended an informal comment period on linkage rulemaking. They're drafting rules related to House Bill 1975, which passed this session, which basically amends the State's Climate Commitment Act to further stabilize the state's carbon market and to help facilitate future linkage with other jurisdictions, like you mentioned, California and Quebec. Perhaps more importantly, California, earlier this month, they voted to extend their cap and trade program, which was set to expire in 2030, but now it's going to run through 2045. The thinking behind that is, that'll put Washington and California on similar timeline in terms of goals and, you know, setting a stage for the California, Washington, and Quebec linked markets. So, you know, they're thinking it's going to make things less expensive. But my question about that is, given California and Quebec are already a part of this market and California already has the highest gas prices in the nation, I wonder if that's really true. Is it really working out like they say it is or say it will?
And by the way, when you said, and I know it's not you speaking, but when you say they say if we don't do this, it'll endanger the system. How does it put the system in danger? Is it just that it causes such insanely high gasoline prices that the public is going to get angry and say, get rid of the whole thing? What is it exactly that puts it in danger?
That's pretty much it. They don't really come out and say that, which is one of the things I've been trying to get Ecology and officials in Washington to admit. I mean, the program is designed to, setting a declining limit on greenhouse gas emissions by, you know, requiring the state's largest emitters to purchase allowances for each metric ton of pollution. It's meant to reduce emissions by making pollution more costly over time. So it's, you know, it's designed to make things more expensive, but, you know, ecology officials and state leaders are loath to admit that. You probably remember back when our former governor, Jay Inslee, was asked about this, and he said it would cost pennies per gallon, and, of course, that has proven not to be the case. And then he went ahead and blamed oil and gas companies' greed for the the higher prices thanks to the carbon auctions.
Okay, because he would make the case that somehow all these dumb oil companies that are so stupid they make billions of dollars, that they went out and stupidly paid more for the carbon credits than they needed to pay? Because that doesn't right. sound like it makes sense.
Well, I mean, obviously these companies are going to pass on any increased cost to customers. That's just economic.
But they're also going to seek the lowest price they can get, aren't they?
Correct. Yes. So, yeah, that's why I was questioning. I wonder if this is going to work out how they say it is or how they want it to. So I guess time will tell. I always thought Inslee's comments about it costing pennies per gallon and then go ahead and blaming the oil and gas companies for their alleged greed in response to people pointing out the higher cost was silly, because if you think back to 5 years ago during the pandemic when a lot fewer people were driving and gas prices plummeted, I didn't hear Inslee or anyone else lauding the oil and gas companies for their generosity and, you know, lowering gas prices. So how come it only works one way?
Hey, can I ask you one, and this may seem like a stupid question. I'm talking to Brett Davis from the Center Square. He's the managing editor. How can Washington State make a deal with a foreign country? I thought that was called a treaty, and it had to be managed by the United States government, and it had to be signed off on by the State Department and probably the U.S. Senate. Can they make with Quebec?
Huh, I'm going to be honest, I had never really thought about that too much. That is definitely something worth looking into. I wish I had an answer I could give you here, but I don't want to make up something.
I mean, not that I want to see Rob Ferguson in handcuffs in an orange jail jumpsuit or anything, but isn't there a thing called the Logan Act that makes it illegal for anybody other than the president or his designee to go off and start cutting international deals with foreign countries, even if they are friendly foreign countries like Canada?
Right. Yeah, you make a good point. That's definitely something for me to check up on. Thanks, Lars. I appreciate the tip.
Well, you know, I'm just, and then to make these interstate compacts, because that's what that is, that should have to be signed off on by the Congress, which I would hope the Republican Congress would say, no, you in California can't do this. But how is it? So they're admitting that the carbon credits are being sold at an artificially high price now, but only if we do the deal with California and maybe Quebec as well, can we bring the artificially high carbon credits down and maybe the cost of gas at the same time? That's what they're admitting?
It seems to be. They don't seem to have any real interest in bringing the cost down. Like I said, it seems pretty obvious. I mean, the whole program is designed to make costs more expensive to reduce pollution, but it's hard to get anyone on record to actually admit that.
Although, do you remember when the great constitutional scholar Barack Hussein Obama talked about how he wanted gasoline to be $8 a gallon?
I do remember that. Thank goodness.
Maybe Washington State.
At least not yet, anyway.
Washington State maybe can get to $8 a gallon before anybody else.
I hope not. I mean, I know we're number two to California, but about a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, we actually surpassed California for a time. So a dubious distinction, to be sure.
Yeah. Unfortunately, things in the Pacific Northwest often become number one, but in the categories you don't want to be number one in, like murder or crime or carbon credits or gasoline
lowest
prices.
Amount of police officers per capita.
Least police officers. So anything else we should know about this proposal for Washington State to join California and Quebec?
Well, it looks like it's full speed ahead on that. So I don't want to end on just bad news. I had talked to somebody from Gas Buddy yesterday for another story I'm working on about what Washingtonians can expect this fall in terms of gas prices. And he seemed pretty confident that prices will actually start to go down in the fall. He estimated maybe 30 to 50 cents by the time we hit Thanksgiving for a variety of reasons, including transitioning to cheaper winter blend gas, an increased supply of crude oil, and the resolution of certain issues out here. I know we had a recent outage on the Olympic pipeline, so, you know, things like that. So
that would be nice to see. Get us to a little bit cheaper gas prices. That's Brett Davis, who is the Pacific Northwest editor at thecentersquare.com. We check on the Center Square all the time. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Coming up in a moment, Kamala Harris has twice failed running for the White House. Yet in her new book, she blames everybody else except herself. Is she trying to rewrite history to cover up her own disastrous record so she can run a third time and fail? We'll talk about that coming up next on the Lars Larson Show.
hours you can't get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
A tyrant. We used to compare the strength of our democracy to communist dictators. That's what we're dealing with right now in Donald Trump.
That is Kamala Harris, and yes, she has run for president a couple of times, failed both times. She ran disastrously most recently last fall and lost in November, despite almost $2 billion in cash that she had available for her campaign, despite the fact that she had 4 years as vice president of the United States. She's now written a book. The book came out this week, and no, I'm not going to spend my hard-earned money to buy a copy of it, but I've been reading some of the things she's had to say. It's also interesting to watch Kamala Harris try to explain some of the things she said. I'm reasonably sure that the book was largely written by a ghostwriter and not by Kamala Harris herself. Although it would be interesting to see if you took some of the word salad that usually comes out of her mouth and tried to make sense of it. If you actually turned that into text, it might make a kind of a funny book. But Kamala Harris is now having a tough time. And who does she blame for her failure the first time? And the second time, because she clearly intends to run a third time for president. That's why she passed up the opportunity to run for governor of California. She turned that down without explanation, but everybody around her said, oh, she's turning down governor because she plans to run for president. And after everybody stopped laughing at that, they said, hold on, she's going to run for president? How is she going to explain why she failed when she was running from the platform of a vice president of the United States with the endorsement of some of the top people, but not all of the top people in the Democrat Party? Well, in the book, she blames everybody except herself for her failures. She even has set up a few landmines for herself. One of those landmines is when she had to explain, why did you choose Minnesota Governor Tim Walz? Well, Tim Walz was a terrible choice as president. And what I've read from the book that has been quoted is that apparently she didn't think much of Tim Walz either, but thought that somehow he would connect with voters because he was easygoing and folksy and all that. But the tougher thing for Kamala Harris is explaining why didn't she choose, say, Pete Buttigieg? Pete Buttigieg, as you might remember, was the failed mayor of South Bend, Indiana, then got picked to be the transportation secretary under Joe Biden. Well, we'll get to him a little bit later, but Kamala Harris literally had to say, well, I didn't pick Pete Buttigieg because he's gay. And you think, hold on, this is a Democrat running for president who's explaining that she won't pick Buttigieg for her vice presidential running mate because he's gay? No, that's crazy. But that soundbite that we began with, a tyrant. That's what we're dealing with Donald Trump. Then she refers to America's democracy. We are not a democracy. We're a representative form of government known as a republic. And then she calls him a communist and says we would often weigh our leaders against communist dictators. And that's what we're dealing with Donald Trump. The funny thing is Kamala Harris is actually out there endorsing communists. One of them is Zohran Mamdani, who is now the odds-on favorite to win as the next mayor of New York City. Take a listen to what she says about Mamdani.
Look, as far as I'm concerned, he's the Democratic nominee, and he should be supported.
Do you endorse his candidacy?
I support the Democrat in the race, sure.
Yeah. If he's got the D in front of his name, that's good enough for Kamala. She doesn't have to actually say why she wants him, but he is a full-on, admits he's a socialist. I think anybody who's looked at his positions on the issues understands he's not just a socialist. He is, in fact, a communist. Before I go further on this review of the book that Kamala Harris has come out with, 107 Days is the name of it. I don't think any of you are going to want to buy a copy of it. Better you just, take a look at the reporting on it and the fact that this woman cannot admit that she's a terrible campaigner and she was a terrible candidate and that she did a terrible job as vice president of the United States. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, part of the problem that Kamala Harris talks about, Number one, she blames Joe Biden in part because she says he waited until so late in the game before he allowed her to become the Democrat Party's nominee when he stepped aside. That gave her 107 days to run for president. And she complains about that short timeline. Here's the problem I would see. She had 4 years as vice president, during which, if she had any capabilities at all, she could have wowed Americans by going out and saying, I'm going to do all these things as vice president, and people would look at her and say, oh, gee, she might make a good president someday. She did not do that. She dodged from every responsibility that was given her, most importantly the one where she was put in charge of figuring out how to solve the problem of the southern border, which Joe Biden wanted to keep open. But then once Joe Biden handed it to her, you even had Nancy Pelosi saying, I'm so sad about Joe. This is from Kamala Harris's notes. It's so tragic. My heart is broken. But now it's you. It's important. There's a process. We have a great bench. We should have some kind of primary, not just an anointment. Yeah, an anointment. Well, guess what we got? There was no primary. There were no votes in favor of Kamala Harris as the Democrat Party nominee. The party decided it for them. There wasn't even a delegate vote. The delegates were not allowed to vote. The American public was not allowed to vote on Kamala Harris. She was simply anointed as the candidate. And then consider what Barack Obama told her when she went to him and said, hey, Joe Biden is still hanging on to it. I would like your endorsement. I'm going to run for president instead. His comment to her was, saddle up. Joe did what I hoped he would do, but you have to earn it. Michelle and I are supportive, but I'm not going to put my finger on the scale right now. Let Joe have his moment. Think about the timing. It's as though everybody knew they might have to endorse her, but they weren't crazy about the idea. And one of those was the current governor of Illinois, big time in more ways than one, J.B. Pritzker. He told her, as governor of Illinois, I'm the convention host. I can't commit. And then Pritzker turned around and endorsed Kamala Harris one day later. And when she called Gavin Newsom, guess what? He said, well, I'm out hiking. I'll call you back. Well, he never did call her back. But a few hours later, he did endorse Kamala Harris, which is not even mentioned in the memoir, because I think Kamala Harris knows that when she goes for the nomination from the Democrat Party, maybe this time with actual votes by citizens and votes by the delegates, one of the people she's going to be running against for that nomination is going to be Gavin Newsom. So I guess she decides that even though he's a major figure in the Democrat Party, she wouldn't even mention him in the book that she wrote about that. And Kamala Harris now calls Donald Trump a communist, but then turns around and endorses a real live communist in Zohran Mamdani. It's absolutely crazy. And here's, I think, the craziest thing. Kamala Harris writes a book in which she dishes, not just on Donald Trump, but she dishes on just about everybody who's a major figure in the Democrat Party. And a lot of those people are the people she will need the endorsement of if she becomes the nominee of the Democrat Party. So she wants to run for president. She wants to dish on the people whose support she needs. And she wants to criticize them and effectively blame them because she didn't get it done. And then, of course, well, I won't get to that. I was going to get to the soundbite where Scott Bessent, who is the current Treasury Secretary, was asked about the fact that Kamala Harris refused to choose Pete Buttigieg. He said it actually shows that she cares more about identity politics than competence. He also says that Pete Buttigieg was probably the worst transportation secretary in American history. Yeah, absolutely crazy. And yet she plans to run for president of the United States. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest.
Lars Larson Show. LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's always my pleasure to welcome back Leland Vittert, host of On Balance with Leland Vittert and chief Washington anchor at News Nation. Leland, I understand you're on a train. Where are you headed?
I am on a train from New York to D.C. Was up in New York doing some publicity and interviews around the book Born Lucky and my Wall Street Journal op-ed about RFK's search for the answers of autism.
Very good. Do you, by the way, since you bring up autism, what do you think of this idea that somehow Tylenol might play a role?
I don't know. I'm not a doctor. Two things can be true at once, which is maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But God bless Trump for finally making this the national conversation that it is. I grew up with autism. Born Lucky's about that book.
And by the way, I've been reminding
you, rather than,
I know we're kind of in and out because of being on a train. You're not sitting in the no cell phone car, are you? Because Joe Biden made that mistake a lot, and it didn't work out well for him.
No, I'm in the cell phone encouraged car. Although, Lars, maybe it's the fact that I'm pulling through Wilmington, Delaware, and they know I'm talking to you, and that's just somehow offensive to the cell phone gods.
Maybe the cell phone blockers they removed in New York City the other day, the Secret Service got to them, maybe they moved them down to Delaware just to keep Joe as quiet as he can be.
All things are possible, but I think the basic point here is there's a lot of people who would much rather score political points against RFK and Trump than they would acknowledge that for the first time we're having a president talk about what is a national health crisis and what should be the scientific question of our time. I asked my staff, and we'll have it tonight on the show, how many press conferences did Joe Biden have about autism? Something that affects one in every 36 kids. That means one in every 12 families. By the way, it's more for poor minority communities. How many press conferences did he have about it, or additional funding did he put in? How many times did he say to go to the NIH and say, I want you to start at the beginning with white paper and no assumptions and come back with a cause or causes? How many?
And you know what, Leland? I'm glad to see that we're having a conversation, because I've had a bunch of medical experts who've said, Lars, come on, the science is settled on this. And I said, oh, look, I was born in 59. My mom was a nurse. I guarantee you, when I got a fever, she gave me aspirin. Now, we did that until 1980, and then all of a sudden found out, hold on a second, this is causing RISE syndrome. We didn't know that before. And it wasn't like we found out in the dark ages. I mean, although I guess 1980 is the dark ages for some people. But for me, I was, I was 21 years old in 1980, and my whole childhood, my mom would have thought nothing of giving me aspirin, even though today it's like, don't give aspirin to kids, don't even give it to teenagers, it's dangerous. So there are lots of things that we take as medical facts until we find out they were wrong, right?
Exactly. Science changes. Science is not the truth. It's the pursuit of truth. But for some reason, that is very offensive to people, which I think is interesting in and of itself. And look, you know, my book goes through the hell that I endured growing up, which was unthinkable, right? You know, seventh grade, the principal called my parents in 2 weeks into school and said, hey, I need to talk to you. Fine. Thought it was a check-in. Hey, everybody here at the school thinks your son, lucky me, is really weird. And frankly, I do too, which meant all the bullying and all of the isolation, everything I was going through was now going to be my fault. Eighth grade, the art teacher said in front of the entire class, hey, you know, if my dog was as ugly as you, I'd shave its rear end and make it walk backwards.
Wow.
Didn't use the word rear end. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's the stories of Born Lucky, what I was going through. Who in their right mind, if, you know, their wife was pregnant right now, or if any woman who was pregnant right now, would anybody check a box and say, oh, gee, I really wish my kid had autism? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So therefore, it's incumbent upon us to do the very best we can to find an answer. Does anybody giving blanket medical advice that doesn't have an MD probably the way to do it? Maybe not. But I think there is a lot of good that is going to come out with that, and we should, at the very least, acknowledge it and celebrate the good, because it's going to help a lot of people.
See, and I agree with that sentiment. So what should we make of the sentiment of women almost immediately after Trump made this announcement with RFK Jr.? And again, I'm not sure about it either, but if there are alternatives to Tylenol, then take the alternative and maybe things will work out better. Women going out and taking Instagrams of themselves downing Tylenol just to do whatever it is that Trump says, do the opposite. What should we make of that?
Look, I don't ever want to cast aspersions on any one person, right? If, you know, the obvious answer is people hate Trump more than they love their children, because why would you, even if there was a tenth of a percent risk, why would you do this, especially when you obviously don't have a fever and don't need it? Why would you be doing this? It's unthinkable, right? Now, that's, I would never want to cast that aspersion on a mother or anybody else. But I think what it shows is exactly the same thing that's happening in the broader sense with the search for the cure, that in there, people sort of hate Trump more than we love collectively Americans, and they would rather have Trump have a political loss than figure out the answers to these really important questions.
By the way, I'm talking to Leland Vittert. He is the author most recently of Born Lucky. Anything else you want to say about your growing up time, and are we doing right by autistic kids right now?
Well, this book is not a cure. It is not a prescription. It is my story. And most of all, what it is it's hope for parents, grandparents, anybody who has a family member, everybody who has a family member or a friend with a kid who is suffering autism, ADHD, anxiety, bullying, physical disabilities, going through school and having a hard time. This is real hope. And I'm not sure you necessarily venerate them in the same way I do, but George Will wrote the foreword of the book, and he said, most of all, it's proof of the mountain-moving power of parental love. That's Born Lucky, bornluckybook.com, to pre-order.
Very good. Hey, I know you're going to talk about Dallas and the killer in Dallas today, who is himself dead, but he shot three people, and immediately we had a lot of the major media say, we have absolutely no idea what the motive is. Please promise me the News Nation is going to not take that dim-witted approach when the killer actually writes messages on the bullets and then shoots three illegal aliens who are in custody and kills two of them, and then say, wow, we're not sure what the motive of this is.
I can't speak for News Nation, Lars. I can only speak for the 9 p.m. hour, 6 p.m. out there on the left coast. Am I allowed to do another plug in your show?
Yes.
Okay, so warnotes.com to subscribe to my newsletter that comes out every afternoon. It's basically my show prep. It's kind of how Lars gets all of his good ideas.
Yeah, well, except for one thing, Leland, I got to tell you, War Notes comes out after my show is over, which is why I can't use it as show notes.
Well, but you would if
late.
You could.
I would if I could. You're right.
And I said, this is what I'm writing, so here's your preview. We are still gathering details, but once again, someone etched talking points of the left on bullets and tried to kill those demonized by the left. Coincidence? I think not.
And I think that Joshua John, already we're seeing indications that he allied himself with Antifa. If that's not true, I'll be happy to be corrected on it. But at this point, it does appear to be that. And you've got a striking number of lefties and Democrats who've been really saying nasty things about ICE. And then they're surprised when somebody goes out and commits an act like this.
Right. No one should be surprised. Like, just like no one should be surprised that they took everyone up on the offer that Charlie Kirk was spreading hate and must be stopped. So when you call ICE the Gestapo, sooner or later, somebody who is dim-witted, I think was the word you used, or otherwise troubled, is going to take you up on that. So is it the fault of those things? No. But rhetoric has consequences.
Absolutely right. That's Leland Vittert, the host of On Balance with Leland, chief Washington anchor at News Nation. Leland, thanks so much for the time. Back in a moment. I'll be glad to get you your calls and emails. 866-HEY-LARS. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
On the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've got a suggestion that maybe the folks involved in Antifa and the siege that they've laid at the ICE headquarters in Southwest Portland, right there on the waterfront in the So What district, I think it's conspiracy to commit murder. I'll make that case in a moment, but first I want to grab some of your calls. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. This segment is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Jeff, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. This is Doc from Eugene. We've talked many times. I sent you an email this morning. I'm really struck by the fact that the shooter is, you know, left-wing, presumably, and yet none of the left-wing are screaming about gun control. It's only if the other side shoots somebody.
Isn't that crazy? Because that's been a new pattern. Ordinarily, if you had any act of violence involving a firearm in the last 20 years, the left usually came out within about 10 nanoseconds and started demanding more laws. And yet, you're right.
Absolutely.
After the Charlie Kirk assassination, after this shooting, you don't hear them calling for more gun laws, and you wonder what message should we take from that?
Oh, God, it's pretty obvious, huh?
Yeah, well, and that and what I was complaining to Leland Vittert about, that already today we had people saying, well, he wrote messages on his bullets. He shot at people at an ICE facility. He killed two illegal aliens who are in custody. He badly wounded one illegal alien who is in custody, did not hit any of the ICE officers. And they say, but we're still unsure about his motive. It's as though they want to be, you know, really, really obviously dense or stupid. I mean, just to say, we have no idea what message he was trying to send. The message didn't come through from what he wrote on the bullets?
Well, they should raise him from the dead and start shaking him to see if he'll talk.
Well, yeah. I don't think, you know, I'm not going to go there. But just, and the obtuseness that the left has about saying, we don't know, we don't see a pattern of left-wing inspired violence. After which people like Jasmine Crockett come out and say that ICE is just like the slave patrols. I mean, the kind of slurs that the left routinely does against law enforcement is just absolutely unconscionable.
I assume you read the Kimmel talk last night or saw
it.
He didn't apologize. That was
nope.
I mean, it's interesting. He went to his Charlie Kirk's wife. And spoke his heart, which was nice. But he really didn't apologize.
No, he didn't. And my understanding is that when he was indefinitely suspended, a suspension that only lasted for a week, he had apparently said, I will not apologize. And as I understand it, the reports of people, you know, these are sourced reports because you're not going to get anybody to talk on the record. But apparently his staff of writers were sort of in the background. And they were saying, if he goes out there and apologizes, we will quit and walk out the door. So that's the hidden message that these left-wing writers who write for Jimmy Kimmel said, if he apologizes, we're gone.
And they're not fixable. They're not changeable. This is permanent stuff that these people feel and say.
Well, did you notice as well, there were two major companies that own TV stations. One is called Sinclair. And the other one is called Nexstar, and they represent about 70% of the TV audience in America. Both of those networks, or both of those companies that own TV stations, remember, ABC is who Jimmy Kimmel works for, but his show is then broadcast by individual broadcast stations, 70% of whom are represented by either Sinclair or Nexstar, and they said, we're not going to air the show. So that means that the number of people, and as I understand it, his ratings have not been in terrific shape, but the stations that would have ordinarily run his show did not run it last night. So an awful lot of the reaction is going to be tempered by the fact that most Americans didn't see it.
Yeah. No, he stepped in the guy is despicable. And the people who follow him, it's inexplicable. Why they follow this baloney and don't at least check the other side. It is Trump derangement syndrome expressed in a variety of ways.
Well, let me suggest something else to you, Jeff. There was a lot of talk after Stephen Colbert was let go about the fact that Colbert's show had been losing something on the order of $40 or $50 million a year. And I know people find that hard to believe. But the fact is, those shows cost a lot of money to produce. You employ a tremendous number of writers and producers and all that. So they're spending a gigantic amount of money to produce the show. They're not making as much money as they spend. And here's where I think ABC is going to get into a bind. Because if, as a lot of us suspect, he has the same kind of situation, maybe not as extreme as Stephen Colbert, but if his show is losing money for ABC and they fired him once and then they got this backlash from both sides, are they going to be able to fire him a second time if they decide to let him go because they say, look, You're costing us a lot of money. You're not making us any money, and you're not doing us any favors. And a lot of our stations do not want to air what you produce. What kind of position does that leave ABC in? I think firing him a second time might be very, very difficult.
I know, and it's going to be a backlash no matter what happens.
Yep, and I think this is why an awful lot of the legacy media, the cartel media that have been around for decades, and they got used to being just a money-making machine for the people who owned them, they're going to be in a tough spot. And I think they're going downhill real fast. And that's not wishful thinking. That's just the numbers, folks. Jeff, thanks for the call. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Again.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. If you're an American like me who wants to be represented in a representative form of government, like the republic that America is, not the democracy that Democrats imagine it is, I'll bet you're like me in saying, we don't need any 1,000-page bills or 2,000 or 3,000-page bills. What we need is a Congress that can actually take on one subject at a time, deal with it, vote on it, vote it up or down, hand it to the president to be signed or not, and not auto-signed, but actually get bills that only deal with one subject at a time. Well, Congressman Russ Fulcher joins me now, who represents Idaho in District 1, and he has reintroduced House Resolution 4324. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Lars, always great to talk to you. It's an honor. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you on the show. So tell my audience, what would H.R. 4324 do?
Well, right now, the way we do legislation in Washington, D.C. is we combine everything. And so there's transportation that's combined with healthcare stuff. There's taxation stuff that's combined with something totally irrelevant on the defense sector or whatever. And so there's always good things in a bill and bad things in a bill. And that's by design. That's how they get things passed that otherwise wouldn't pass. But the bottom line is it's a bad way to legislate. They're hundreds, thousands of pages long. And it's just a bad way to govern. And Lars, I got to tell you, we haven't passed a budget and we haven't done the full appropriation process since 1997, 1998. This is part of the reason why, is because we do all these big omnibus bills and we should be looking at things one issue at a time, weigh it on its merits, vote it up or down, and move on to the next one.
Okay, and I understand why people who write these things probably find it attractive on both sides of the aisle, because they can say, well, I voted for the bill that got us a new dam or got us a new this or got us a new that, and then they can ignore the part of the bill that they know their constituents would not like. It's true to say this is probably attractive to members of Congress on both sides of the political aisle, isn't it?
That is true. It's kind of a clever way to do earmarks, if you will. If you can't get someone's vote on a particular issue, you say, hey, you know what? We got a big bill coming up. It's got to pass. It's the defense bill or whatever. And so, you know what? We're going to slip that bridge that you need in your region, your district, into that bill, and you'll get it that way. And again, you know, it's the state of Idaho has a single subject rule within their legislature, and it's not a perfect way to govern, but and you know, there's always multiple things, but it's on the same topic, and I just think we would be much better served if we were debating these things up and down, and it will take a little bit more time, but it's just a better way to govern, Lars.
Well, and what I wonder about is when I say, well, why don't you just do regular order on budgeting? We're coming up on October 1. That's the beginning of the federal fiscal year. Say, okay, starting next year, we're going to introduce individual bills. There will be a bill for defense. There will be a bill for health and human services. There will be a bill for HUD. There will be a bill for the Department of Ed, which has a $0 sign at the top of it. Whatever you do, if the House Speaker said we will introduce that bill, what would prevent the Congress from saying we're going to pass that bill on its own, send it over to the Senate? And I know you've got a bare majority in both chambers. But if you did that and folks said, well, what about the rest of the budget? Say, well, the rest of the budget will be everything except the one we just voted on. And maybe we can get five or six of them through and you could work your way back to doing things with 13 separate appropriations bills. Does anything stop that from happening other than wanting to have something attractive attached to the ugly part so you can go back and brag about the attractive part to your constituents, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican?
Well, we have made some progress in doing exactly that on the House side. I will tell you this year, or this time around, the big, beautiful bill, which was a priority of the president, kind of sidetracked that effort. And that's often the case. There's going to be a pet project or a major issue that has to be dealt with. It sucks up a lot of time, takes us off track. But the bottom line is it comes down to management and the amount of time you spend in Washington, D.C. I think that we should just be spending the time we need. If that means we're here on weekends, it means we're here on weekends, whatever it is. But the House does most of that. We've got, I think, 9 of the 12 appropriation bills passed, but it does get complicated on the Senate side. As you know, that needs 60 votes to pass on the Senate side. There's not a Republican majority that big in the Senate, so it does tend to get cobbed up there. There's another reason. We're making some progress, but we're not where we need to be.
Okay, but Congressman, I'm going to speak, and you know that I'm going to show my total ignorance of Capitol Hill. And frankly, as an American, I don't want to know about Capitol Hill, just like I don't want to know how sausage is made. But if you sent, say, defense appropriations bill over to the Senate, and the Democrats say, yeah, we're not going to vote on it. Okay, great, we'll have a vote. We're going to have a vote, and you can vote no on the defense budget. And then we're going to tell the whole country that it was the Democrats that defeated the defense budget or health and human services. If you did that and they actually had their feet held to the fire and you said, if you want to vote no on HHS or HUD or education or whatever, go ahead and do it and see how that works out with your constituents. Wouldn't that be a powerful lever to use?
I think it would be. And it's that amount of intestinal fortitude probably doesn't exist in Congress right now. We have sent appropriations over there. This time they will say, hey, we've got Senate confirmations. We don't have time to do that. So we come back and it is solved through what's called a conference committee, which is a joint House Senate negotiation, if you will. So that's what actually happens, but quite frankly, if we took the process that you just laid out, we would all be better as a result of it.
Well, and what's the likelihood you can get a majority of your friends on the Republican side to vote for H.R. 4324, and is there any appetite for any of the Democrats to do the same?
I've launched this bill every single year that I've been in Congress. We have made some progress. We've got a little bit of a bipartisan support now, and it's because of some of the massive numbers of issues that were addressed with Big Beautiful Bill and other things like that. So we're making some progress, but to be perfectly honest, this is more of a lever for me internally and for those of us who believe in this when we come up on some of the inner negotiations. So is it realistically going to pass? No, not this year. However, it's out there. We will continue to drive it. It is making some progress. And the point is being made every time we get some of these sausage-making processes underway.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Congressman, I wish you well because I want to see this thing happen. And I wish Congress, 535 of you, and everybody's telling me, well, we don't have time for that. I say, well, maybe you need to put in, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year. You can take 2 weeks off for vacation and maybe you can escape in August. But, get the work done. And folks always tell me, oh, no. We're working as hard as we can. It's at least 2 or 3 days a week. I want to see Congress work hard, get the job done. And I think the American public is going to love it. And I think the voters are going to look at the other side of the aisle and next November, and I think they're going to give you an even bigger majority. That is Representative Russ Fulcher, who represents Idaho's Congressional District Number 1. Congressman, thanks for the time. Back in a moment, glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. A freshman girl forced out of her own locker room because a boy who identifies as a female refuses to leave, and then school administrators backed him up. I'll get to that story coming up next.
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I think this is a very simple question, and it really suggests a very simple answer. Should girls have to tolerate schools that allow biological boys with psychological problems watch them undress? Should they have to tolerate that? I don't think that's a hard question. And yet for the left, it is a question that immediately raises all kinds of issues. I want to get into one specific example of this. A freshman girl who went to change her clothes for gym class and found a guy in the locker room. Now, it's a familiar story, but I think we should understand this is still going on despite the best efforts of both some state officials around the country and President Trump himself trying to change that situation. Let me get into those details in a moment, but first to your calls. Let's start with Joseph. Hey, Joseph, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
This is Joseph Enos.
Joseph, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi there. It was mostly a question about the separation of church and state. I wonder, based on, you know, what we are going through in this country, if you what your thoughts were on how the very horrific events that have happened in the last few weeks really should be put into politics, because I do agree with the separation of church and state.
Well, where do you find the separation of church and state? Because I know where that phrase came from, and I know where it is, and I know where it's not. Where did you get the idea that church and state must be separated based on what?
Well, I can't say that I'm the most educated person on the show.
That's okay. There are lots of people who get this one wrong. It was in a letter that Jefferson wrote when he was president to a bunch of Baptist ministers, and it had to do primarily with telling the government, stay out of people's religion, stay out of their churches,
yes,
stay out of their beliefs.
Sense.
It didn't have anything to do with prohibiting religion taking a role in our government. Because, for instance, every single American president, even dimwit Joe Biden, would end every speech with, and God bless America, which is clearly a religious statement. And, of course, you go to the Supreme Court of the United States, there are bas-relief decorations inside the Supreme Court chambers that depict religious figures, primarily Christian religious figures. There's no requirement that religion cannot come into the halls of government. In fact, it needs to be in there more. There's only a prohibition on the government telling you and me what we should or should not practice as our faith. So if you
think
we're...
And I would agree, because mostly, for the most part, religion has kind of led us to the right moral compass that we should be abiding by, including even our own government.
Agreed. So where do you find the entry of religion to be troubling you right now about what's happened in the last couple of weeks?
Not me personally. However, I find it troubling that, because I am conservative, I will say that. I just find it troubling that some people don't like, you know, if we're going to talk about the assassination, that's mainly where I get this from, is that I think it's kind of ridiculous that people want to divide our country even more, when I truly think that, you know, a lot of this moral compass comes from the right, which I fully believe in.
Well, and I would agree with you that much of our moral compass as human beings comes from our faith. And in America is a predominantly Christian country. It comes from the Christian faith. And there are people who don't like that. They would like it if American became an atheist nation. We're not going to let that happen. The founding documents of this country prohibit that from happening. We're not going to become an atheist nation. But the farther we go from our faith, I think the worse we go in terms of our situation. Let me quickly tell you about this story out of Fairfax County, Virginia. So imagine this. This is your daughter or your granddaughter, a freshman girl, goes to school in Fairfax County High School. She goes into gym class to change her clothes to go out for exercise. She runs into a male student, also a boy. She's a girl, he's a boy. And the administrator said, we will investigate. They came back 2 days later, and they said to this girl and her parents, if your daughter is uncomfortable with a male student watching her in the locker room, she should go somewhere else and change. 1 week after initially entering the girls' locker room, this is from National Review, the boy again entered the girls' locker room and watched the girls change for P.E. That's according to the complaint that was filed. Administrators told the boy to stop using the girls' facilities until they came up with a solution. He refused. He said, I'm going to continue to use the girls' locker room. So this is a militant trans who's saying, I'm going to stand in the girls' locker room and watch them change in and out of their clothes. The administrators called to inform the girl's mother of the decision, and they explained the boy had a right to use the girls' locker room because he identifies as female. So the parents filed a complaint against the Fairfax County Schools and said, you've got to do something about this. They asked that the Department of Education investigate the situation and revoke federal funding from the district if steps are not taken to protect female students from male intrusion. So even though Americans voted for Donald Trump, who promised that this would be one of the issues that he would help resolve, despite that message loud and clear from the American electorate, what happens? The local schools act as though they are powerless. Now, I'm going to tell you that I think those schools are not powerless. They should tell the young man, enter that space one more time. We will call the police and tell them that you have been warned, that you are trespassing, that you're invading people's privacy, that you are stealing from these girls their right to be in a private space when they're changing clothes. And if the schools don't do that, then the local community needs to go out and elect a new school board. And if they won't do that, well, then you keep electing new school boards until you find one that will. And if it takes threats of removal of federal funding from Washington, D.C., fine. Frankly, I don't think there should be any federal funding of local schools. Giving faceless, nameless bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. any say-so over your local schools is absolutely one of the most foolish things I've ever heard of. Let's go to John. Hey, John, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Lars. Listen, I was listening to you talk to that earlier guest about the international, you know, the effort to have an international climate carbon credit trading environment.
Oh, yeah, where they want to hook Washington State and California and Quebec
and
together
Quebec, yes. In a
carbon trading.
I mean, I agree. It's certainly true that the United States has to weigh in on it and make it a treaty. It has to be a treaty arrangement, I believe. But the thing that really bothers me the most about it is that right now we have these credits being traded in private markets that we don't have access to. The buyers and the sellers speculate and hold back these artificial assets and raise the value of them, and then that in turn causes the new credits to be released at a higher price. And it's a really diabolical scam against us. It drives our costs up artificially.
Yep.
And it's not doing anything to preserve the our woodlands. Washington State Constitution requires that Washington timberlands be sold to fund schools.
Yeah, but focus on the carbon credits. It's effectively a gas tax, and based on state law in Washington State, gas taxes have to be spent on the roads. But as long as they make it a carbon tax, they can say we can spend the money on anything we want. And right now, they're treating it as a giant $4 billion slush fund, and that is just dead wrong. You got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest.
The Lars Larson Show. Political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I want to talk about Antifa and the fact that President Trump has designated Antifa as a major terrorist organization and whether or not that's going to give local law enforcement a bit more in the way of tools to go after these people in this organization. Mike Solon joins me now, who's the Seattle Police Officers Guild president, so he heads up the union. Mike, welcome to the program.
Lars, big fan. Happy to be here, sir.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that the kind words. But tell me this. Does this give your officers on the streets some additional leverage in going after some of the Antifa who get away with a lot these days?
Well, they get away with a lot, for sure. It depends upon what our local administration will do with this executive order. This is incumbently going to be coming down to the federal agents, the federal departments of law enforcement to come in and actually start to dictate terms. Locally speaking, I try to be optimistic, but I do not feel as if the courage, the political courage is there to allow local police departments, such as those in Seattle, to enact on this executive order. I just don't see the connection there unless the feds step in and start being proactive, like we're seeing in Portland.
Well, I mean, the feds can do it because they're under the direction of the DOJ, but would Seattle City Hall actually turn to the Seattle Police Department and say, yeah, we don't care if you catch some Antifa terrorists engaged in terrorist activities. We want you only to charge them under local laws, and we don't want you to pursue them as a terrorist organization. Would they go that far?
I'm not sure, Lars. I don't have much hope that the courage, the political will would be there in Seattle to make that a reality. That's the answer to your question. Given the experience we've seen since 2020, even in before that, 2020 in particular, I mean, the Antifa, they're vile individuals. They are bent on destroying the rule of law, to demoralize law enforcement, to divide us from our communities. These people will use violence at all ends. We've seen that time and time again with the hundreds of officers that were injured in 2020 riots. Seattle was the proving ground of that. And that action continues in Portland and in Seattle at the same time. I do not think that elected officials in these progressive blue cities will have the courage to entice local law enforcement to actually go after these Antifa thugs.
I just wonder whether you can shame them into it, because after the events of this week, you have this shooting in Dallas, and I actually had a TV station talk to me about it, and they said, but the guy who killed himself, the killer, who also shot three people at the Dallas police, or at the Dallas ICE headquarters, he also shot three illegal aliens. Two of them were in, all three were in custody, two were killed, one was seriously wounded, and they said, but how do you know he's, you know, how do you know he's Antifa or that he's doing this? I said, they're anti-ICE, but Antifa seems to be anti-everything. So if we know that an organization that has been around now for a number of years and has already conducted violent activities in American cities, most especially going back to the summer of 2020, you know, where billions of dollars of damage was done, murders were committed, and you say, and now we see that they're out literally targeting people, and they said, but that doesn't seem like a, you know, an Antifa. And I said, no, Antifa doesn't give a damn about anybody's life. And I don't think they really cared whether they hit the immigration officers, the ICE officers, or hit the detainees, because life doesn't seem to mean much to these people. Are you really going to tell your police department, don't go after these people after the kinds of acts we know that they take part in?
Well, I want to be clear. I mean, you're spot on, Lars, as usual, but I want to be clear. The law enforcement officers in these cities want to uphold the rule of law. That's why we swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. It's called basically our certification. We pledge to defend the Constitution. That's our role. We want to do our jobs. The issue at hand is that Antifa are the foot soldiers of the radicals, the leftists that are in charge, these activists, the unreasonable activists, and they will continue to do their bidding. And so it just comes down to local prosecutors. When officers arrest someone for criminality, as we know, Antifa engages in criminality to bully their way to upend the rule of law. It comes down to the prosecutors, whether or not, and the judges, if they have the courage to provide jail and prison sentences to those that violate crime. I am just not seeing, it's way too early, but I am not too confident that local officials will have the courage to then go after what has predominantly been the foot soldiers that have enacted the activism to thwart whatever type of mission that they've been given, such as the riots in 2020. We dealt with those Antifa thugs. We've been doing it for years. Now the flavor of the day is the same agitators, these same foot soldiers, are being used to target ICE. Anything that goes against the political mission of whoever's in power in these major blue cities, they're going to be hard-pressed to go after their foot soldiers, for sure.
By the way, I'm talking to Mike Solon. Mike, you know what it reminds me of? And I was a kid when this happened, but Rudy Giuliani went after the five big crime families in New York, and they've been around forever. And everybody had, you know, law enforcement would pick off a foot soldier now and then. But basically nothing more than that. And they finally got RICO in place, and they said these are organizations that send their foot soldiers out to do evil things. You, in their case, they were mostly motivated by money. In this case, it's just chaos is what they seem to want to do. And for decades, law enforcement said there's nothing we can do about these guys. We're going to get their foot soldiers, but we're never going to get to the folks who are running it. That seems like really ripe territory to go after an organization that's now been designated as a terrorist organization and say, we're going to find out who funds them. We're going to find out how they're organized, who's calling the shots, using probably social media and instant messaging and everything else. And we're going to take these organizations apart, or we're going to keep losing people, you know, citizens, to their violence. And I would think that I know the King County Prosecutor's Office, I'm very disappointed in them, not so much with the, you know, Seattle City Attorney's Office, but you'd think they'd say, yeah, we want to go after those guys. And if they say, no, we don't have the political will to do it, they're just simply saying we're willing to sacrifice some citizens and their lives and their safety.
Well, I can tell you, Lars, that the people that are going to continue to pressure our local officials, prosecutors, and county prosecutors to enforce the rule of law is going to be police unions and associations. That's our role. We have to stand up for the cops on the street that go about their business to try to do their job effectively. The problem is that these policies that have basically handcuffed the officers from actually enforcing law and holding people accountable. But for context for this conversation, you're so true to look at the RICO thing. That is going to be a Fed and strategy. Couldn't agree with you more. For the audience to listen, for context, in 2020, before the election, we're talking when the riots started until the November election where President Biden was elected into office. On the day the election was over, Lars, the apparatus that kept these Antifa thugs in operation, such as food trucks, vendors, tents, you name it, the logistics, once the election was over, they all packed up and they left. From that point on, we didn't have the day in and day out marches and riots that we experienced. It was gone. So yes, you are right. There's a financial connection here, and the RICO investigation is going to uncover, I'm confident, of who these people were that were financing these foot soldiers to do their bidding.
I certainly hope you're right, Mike, because, you know, the feds during Biden could tell you everything you ever wanted to know about everybody who was there on J6. But then you say, well, who's behind all the Antifa stuff where billions of dollars of damage and 36 murders and everything else? Oh, we have no idea what's going on there. I hope that the Trump DOJ will go after that apparatus, identify the people who are putting the money up, and take care of it. That's Mike Solon, who is the president of the Police Officers Guild in the city of Seattle. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails. This segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists at Oregon Medical Centers. And, of course, every day we write a brand new poll question. We call it the X Poll. You can find it on X at Lars Larson Show. Should narco-terrorists shipping drugs into the U.S. get their day in court, or was Trump right to take them out? We're talking about at least a couple of drug runner boats that got blown up in international waters. And Hillary Clinton is now saying we should have given due process to those people. Look at what we're doing in the Caribbean, shooting boats, you know, people with 7 to 10 people on the boats. No due process, no real definition of why, other than that, they might be drug runners. They don't have to kill those people. not exactly picking the most popular subjects to talk about, are you, Hillary? So the question is, should the narco-terrorists who are shipping drugs into the U.S., a reminder, about 100,000 people die of drug overdoses every year in America, should those drug runners get their day in court, as Hillary says, or was Donald Trump right to have the military take them out with a drone? To your calls now. Let's go to Jeff, who's a naysayer. Hey, Jeff, you may be the first naysayer today, I believe. Welcome to the program. What do we disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Oh, about the blowing up boats, you know, no proof. But no, what I want to talk about is what I find annoying. You said something the other day about, I don't know which guest you were talking to, about, you know, being a flawed human being and we're all sinners.
Yes.
Well, I'm not religious, and I get annoyed when I hear people like you, religious people, saying we're all sinners. I don't.
Why are you annoyed?
I don't believe it. Because it's just annoying to hear somebody say we're all sinners. When I don't believe in sin, I don't believe in God. You know, your God or the Bible. You know, all that nonsense.
So, is there any such thing as sin in your world?
There's moral and immoral behavior. Sin's just a word made up in the Bible. Sin is behavior. It's a word. It's
yeah,
a description.
But it's behavior that is morally repugnant behavior, and you'd agree that there is, no matter what word you want to call it by, if you want to use a different word for it, you can go ahead. Actually, the Bible doesn't use sin as much as it does iniquities. But, okay, so you want to call it by a different word, but there is sin, right?
There is immoral, moral behavior. Society.
Okay, and are we all guilty of engaging in immoral behavior?
Yes, I would say so. And
then what do we disagree about?
Yes.
What do we disagree about?
I get tired of hearing the whole sinner thing. You're including me in your sinner.
Yes, I am. Unless you claim to be the one person who's without sin, and I only know one of those.
Oh, yeah, and he got nailed to a piece of wood for his trouble.
And then came back to life and ascended into heaven. Good, you know some history. I thought you didn't know anything about Christianity.
According to you and your belief, he came back, you know.
Well, it sounds like you're familiar with it, too, Jeff. Or are you just trying to forget? Because it sounds like you know the story, right?
Oh, I was raised in it, and that's why I don't believe in it. Because it's all fairy tales and made-up stuff by man. Man has created God in his image. Because, explain to me, why would God get angry? Why would God be happy? Why would God be sad? Those are human.
Why would he be angry, sad, or wrathful, or a number of other things? He even hates some people. He hated Esau. So why would he? Because he has a personality. God is wrathful. God can be joyous. God can be a lot of things, but you would deny his existence. Can you tell me then how life came to be?
I just deny the existence of a supreme being. I just don't buy into the Bible version of the supreme being. And you said,
why?
God could be wrathful. Why would God be wrathful?
Because he's deeply disappointed in some of his sinful beings that he created?
Let me make this point then. He's disappointed. How can you disappoint God when he knows what you are going to do yesterday, today, and 20 years from now?
Do you know any parents who expect that someday their kids are going to lie to them? Or their kids may steal. In other words, you know it's likely to happen, but you're still disappointed when it happens, aren't you? We are his children. He knows what his kids are going to do, and he's still disappointed when we do the wrong thing. How is that unnatural to you?
Because that's God, your God's plan. He has a plan, supposedly, for all of us.
He does. You do know a lot about Christianity for a guy who doesn't believe. I'm impressed.
I was raised in it. I had to read the Bible. I was forced to read it.
How did you fall away?
Nonsense.
How
until
did you
I got
fall
old
away?
Enough when the church ladies couldn't answer tough questions at Sunday
Can
school.
Can you help me out then? I've got a mystery then. I'm confused. Where do you get your moral compass?
From society's rules. Just like every society throughout history has had moral and law.
Not all of them. There are some very amoral societies that have existed on planet Earth. If you know that much history, you know that's true.
Good societies have always had moral standing and laws to go by. There's no society.
So in other words, laws made by men that can be rewritten by men or forgotten by men. They don't sound very permanent to me.
Yes, at any time, yes. Because history and life...
But then I'd ask you, where do you get your moral compass?
from society.
Okay, then let me ask you something. In some parts of American society, it's okay to mutilate children to turn them from one gender to another. Is that moral or not moral?
No, let's not start.
No, I want to ask you a simple question. Is it moral to mutilate children to try to turn them from one gender to another?
Oh, come on, Lars. You're really going off the rails.
It's a simple question, Jeff, and I can see you can't answer it. That's all right. You're a good naysayer. Thanks very much. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.